All right.
Yeah, this is a... So you might notice we don't have a stage, and that's by design because, you know, Dave Hubbard is so tall. We were absolutely impressed and intimidated by him standing over us last week. So we thought that we would give ourselves a little bit of a sense of... deal with our inferiority complex. That was tough to get out this morning. Sorry about that. Just glad you're here today, and for the guys online, glad to see y'all, and we're delighted that you're here. It's that fall feeling. How many people like the fall feeling? All right. How many people would rather it be 90 degrees and humid? Yeah, okay, we got a couple of y'all. All right, that's good. All right, well, fantastic. It's dark, but you're here, and that's a good thing. So without further ado, Steve Peterson is out today. Dave Hubbard's going to continue our series in talking about Peter, and Steve will be back with us next week. So let's give thanks and begin. Father, thank you for this day. There's not a man in this place or online today that's here by mistake. You are sovereign. You brought each person here. And Father, it's not to waste their time, but it's to impart your word and to build us up in the fellowship of a brotherhood. And I pray we would leave this place, whether we feel it or not, changed and ready to engage the world that you've called us into for your glory and our good. And Father, I do want to pray for Dave. Lord, anoint him by your Holy Spirit and let your words be his words in Jesus' name. Amen.
Good morning, man. I, along with you, am greatly looking forward to Steve coming back and us diving back into Exodus. A little disconcerting this morning is my table. Didn't Jesus say a prophet's not honored at his own table? I think that's... Randy, I appreciate you. We began with our kind of character study with Peter, with Jesus' statement to Simon upon first meeting him, where he said, "You are Simon, son of John." And Simon actually words, and we've talked about this, how names really meant something then, not so much today. And Simon meant the listening one, and I'm sure Simon was very much aware of that. He said, "You are Simon, son of Jonah. You will be called Peter, the Rock." And I would think at Simon at that point thought, "Well, that's pretty cool. I'll take the Rock over the listening one any day of the week." And then we looked at that as Jesus essentially saying to him, "You are, you will become." And I postulated that that's what Jesus says to each of us when we meet him for the very first time. "You are who you are now. Follow me, and you will become someone completely different. You will become what I created you to be." There's an undoing process where we must be stripped of bad habits, stinking thinking, wrong attitudes, job of a football coach to which he... It's in Tom Landry's answer to the question, "What is the job of a football coach?" to which he replied, "The job of a football coach is to make men do what they don't want to do, in order for them to achieve what they've always wanted to be." And we see the same principle played out in the human body as it relates to building strength in nature. You know, when it comes to strength, staying conditioned, as probably most of you know, you have to really stress the body. When I moved to Atlanta in 1989, I began doing lectures, presentations, seminars to companies and organizations on physical fitness, on health and fitness. This was before that had really taken off, so to speak, in the corporate world. And when I would do, my title was How to Better Manage Your Most Valuable Asset. And when I would talk, I would notice that there were a lot of people who just didn't get it, and I couldn't understand why they were so disconnected. And then I came to realize that, you know, unless you played a sport, unless you had pushed your body to the limit, you really don't understand how all of that works, and there's a lot of people, unfortunately, who don't. They didn't play a sport. PE has been relegated to practically nothing. And so when it comes to building strength, it comes to the body. God designed the body to be stressed. Stress the heart, stress the brain, stress the muscles. And when you do, it weakens it, okay? It undoes it, so to speak. But then when it recovers, it heals stronger than it was before. Strength, that's how strengths develop. We see this in many instances in nature. One of my favorites is with the butterfly and the cocoon. If you make just the tiniest of slits in that cocoon, that butterfly will come out weak and in many cases unable to fly. Why? Because as God designed it, there's a struggle going on in that cocoon where the butterfly is fighting to get out. And in doing that, in that struggle, tremendous strength is built so that when that cocoon bursts, the butterfly can fly. Simon begins his journey to becoming Peter by hanging out with Jesus. But that all changes when he decides to obey Jesus against his better judgment with the fishing incident in his boat. Then astonished and extremely fearful, finding himself face to face with God on his boat, he bows in humble submission and faces what I call the I am issue. I am a sinful man. And to his surprise at that point, Jesus' response to that humble submission is, "Don't be afraid, follow me." Then, seeing what first looked like a ghost walking on the water, Simon, after recognizing it was Jesus and remembering Christ's admonition to not be afraid and follow him, asks if he can be a water walker too. And Jesus said, "Come," and he did. He walked on the water, but taking his eyes off Jesus, leaning on his own understanding, he sank, only to have Jesus immediately rescue him. And that brings us to this morning's events with Peter. But before I jump into the text, let me give you a true story and then an analogy. There's a true story of a woman, this was many years ago, who was in the third trimester of her pregnancy, and she developed some complications that they really couldn't understand. They couldn't define what it was. It was unlike anything the doctors had experienced before. There was some sort of mass in her stomach. And so taking x-rays, they could recognize that, but didn't understand what it was or what the situation was. And so the doctors were collaborating with each other. And one day, her doctor was having lunch with who was her primary care doctor and had been her primary care doctor since she was a small child. And he mentioned in passing that she always had long hair. She always had her hair over her shoulder, and she had a habit of putting her hair in her mouth. They operated and removed almost a 5-pound hairball in her stomach. It's called trichophagia. It actually exists. There's a pamphlet that was written by Robert Munger years ago called My Heart, Christ's Home. And what he did in that little pamphlet was give an illustration of how, what if our heart were like a house? And so the illustration goes something like this, that when we come to Christ, when we submit to him, we give him the master key to our dwelling, okay? Which is supposed to fit every door, every cabinet, everything. And we say to him, "Christ, I'm yours. You come in, you do whatever you want. Rearrange my life, rearrange the house of my heart." And so at that point, Jesus comes in and he begins to make changes. He says, "That picture's got to go. You know, let's rearrange the furniture a little bit here. That chair's got to go. Let's bring in something else." And he begins to go in and take an inventory. But invariably, he comes to a cabinet, a pantry, a closet, a room that he puts his that's locked. He goes to go in and it's locked. He puts his master key in and it doesn't work. And he looks, follows his eyes up to a padlock that's been put on that room. He doesn't have that key. And so now the question is, what does he do? I used to think, you know, that at that point, Jesus back down the hall, comes running, jiu-jitsu style, kicks the door down. It's his, right? But that's not what happens. Jesus begins a process of motivating us to give him that key. And that's really what we see this morning with Simon. So turn to Matthew 16:13. Now, I believe that Simon has to be constantly wondering, when does the name change take place? Because up to this point, Jesus has continued. He says, "Your name's going to change," from Simon to Peter, but he keeps calling him Simon. He doesn't call him Peter. So it's got to be in the back of Peter's head going, when is that going to happen? When is that going to happen? And we see it happen here. You're familiar with this passage. Jesus comes to the region of Caesarea Philippi. He asks his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asks, who do you say that I am? And Peter blurts out, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter. Yes! It's happened. I was Simon, son of Jonah, now I'm Peter. I'm the rock. And then it gets even better from a kind of a heady stuff if you're not really, you know, I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Verse 21, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside. Oh my goodness. Unbelievable. So we've gone from cowering in fear on the boat, in humble submission, I am a sinful man, to Peter, Jesus, really, come on. We need a little sidebar here, okay? You're kidding, right? Nobody, that's not going to happen, because I'm here. I'm the rock, remember? I'll take care of anything like that. And I understand you're a little nervous, Jesus, about that kind of thing, but no worries, I'll take care of it. Wow. Peter's got a blind spot. Peter's got a hairball. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. So he goes from Simon, son of Jonah, to Peter the rock, to Satan. I mean, wow. But even after that smackdown, Peter's not done. He's still convinced that if things get ugly, he'll rise to the occasion and be the hero. Look now at Luke chapter 22, verse 31. Luke 22, verse 31. Now he's called him Peter. We've shifted. He's called him Peter. We had the brief interlude with Satan. And now Jesus said, this is an amazing statement. He says, Simon, Simon, and he repeats it twice. And anytime something is said twice in that language, in that culture, it's with tremendous emphasis. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat. Wow. This is now similar to Job, what happened with Job. Satan has come and asked permission to do some stuff to Peter. And Jesus has given permission for that to happen. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And catch this. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. He tells him that he's going to fail. But if Simon, the listening one, is actually really listening, he heard in that he's going to make it through that. Because Jesus is praying for him. And he's given him the idea that he's going to make it through. But Simon, not listening, replied, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. Wow. But Jesus answered, I'll tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me. That exchange actually happened twice. It happened, Jesus is saying, and it also happened again on the way to Gethsemane. Jesus is saying, Peter is saying, even if all fall away, I will not. Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. That is a bold, confident statement. Peter has no idea what's coming. He's about to be undone. He's about to go through an emotional roller coaster ride that will have his head spinning and his stomach tied in knots. Jesus was constantly warning not only to Peter but to the rest of his disciples that to become, they must be undone. John 12:24, I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Following Christ is about dropping dead daily. It's a life of death to self. It's a life of constantly getting out of the way so that when people look at us, they don't see us, they see Jesus. It's John the Baptist's statement, he must become greater and I must become less. We pick things up in verse 47. While he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? When Jesus' followers saw what he was doing, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them, in this case Peter, struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. Man, he was not aiming for his ear. Okay, I guarantee you that. He was aiming for his head. So it's easy to be hard on Peter through everything that happened with the denial and so on, but we got to give credit where credit is due. At this point, he is stepping up to do something as he understands the confusion of what's happening. But at that point, Jesus answered, no more of this, and he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. What a statement. Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. And Peter followed at a distance. I've heard messages on just that line. Peter followed at a distance. And we get in trouble when we follow Jesus at a distance. Okay? But again, credit where credit's due. The rest of them left, except for John. And so it's just John and Peter, and John's actually with Jesus. Peter's following at a distance. In fact, if we look at the John account of this, it says, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus because this disciple was known, this is John, to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in to the courtyard. Interesting. And to which she said to Peter, and at this point, I mean, come on, really? He's with John. Then John goes in, John comes back out, speaks to him. It's pretty obvious that he's with John and with Jesus. Aren't you one of this man's disciples too? So back to the passage that we're looking at. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. But he denied it. Woman, I don't know him, he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are with them. Man, I am not, Peter replied. About an hour later, this is amazing. I've had things happen where it happens fast, kind of in succession. He's got an hour to think about this. He's been sitting there for an hour after the first two denials. After an hour, someone inserted, certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean. They recognized his accent. They're trying to figure out who is this guy and why is he here. And Peter replied, man, I don't know what you're talking about. In another account, it says he brought down cursing. What happened here is the old fisherman, Peter, just came totally undone. And he became, out came the language of his former life, out came the anger and the vile rebuke of saying, I don't know him. And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and he wept bitterly. I call this the lie, the alarm, the look. How about you, but I, the lesson, and the tears. And man, I don't know about you, but I've been through that sequence. I've been through the lie, the alarm, the look, the lesson, the tears. But I'm convinced that if it were not for the Lord turning and looking straight at Peter, and even more importantly, what was communicated in that look, that Peter would likely have committed suicide like Judas. They had to both be as rock bottom as you could possibly be, based on what they recognized had happened. So what's happening here is he's in the courtyard. Coming out of the building was a hallway with columns. And just as he denies for the third time the rooster crows, Jesus, as it says, looks at him. And something was communicated in that look. So we ask, what was it, do you think? Was it, Simon, you idiot? Did I not tell you so? I can't believe you let me down again. You miserable failure. Was that what was in the look, do you think? No. In Jesus' eyes and in the countenance of his face, in just that brief instance, Peter saw unimaginable, undeserved love, compassion, and forgiveness. And in that look, Peter, I believe, remembered Jesus saying, I have prayed for you, Simon. I am praying for you that your faith will not fail. And when you have turned back, when you recover from this, and you will, strengthen your brothers. You can beat this, Peter. You can learn from this. This is exactly what you needed to become all that you are capable of becoming as my disciple. Peter had failed God miserably, but God had not failed Peter. Peter was prideful. And unless and until he was willing to give Jesus the key to the padlock of that pride pantry and allow him to remove that pride and replace it with humility, he would never become what God intended him to be and prepared him to be. For to become, you must be undone. But once undone, God can redo. Concerning pride, Chuck Swindoll once said, people who live proud, unbroken lives may become great, gain popularity, and accomplish incredible things. But all that power and pride stands against the qualities that God considers great. I had an instance kind of similar to this, and because I believe that all of us, though many times not aware of it, we deny Christ. We deny Christ. You know, it's one thing in the workplace to say, to let it be known to others that you're religious. I'm a religious person. Even more popular today than I'm a religious person, I'm a spiritual person. I'm into spirituality. But when you say, I believe that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and the only way to heaven, and the only way to get back into a personal relationship with the created universe, now you've stepped over a line. Christ followers, okay? And so by how we present ourselves as Christians and Christ followers, can we deny Christ? I believe we can. For me, a situation happened where when I went to the New Orleans Saints, when I was in college, I didn't ever think that professional football was even a possibility. And then that began to develop through college, and it ended up my senior year that it looked like it was going to happen. I was All-American. I played in the Senior Bowl. And so I had scouts and agents and everybody telling me that I would not go below the third round. And so I thought that would be the case, and it wasn't. Of course, back then, ESPN didn't exist. It wasn't what you see today with everybody sitting in a room where they have a camera in the home and, you know, we're just whatever. I'll get a call, I guess, at some point. And instead, I went in the fifth round. But not only did I go in the fifth round, but they drafted another offensive tackle in the fifth round. Two of us. Now, the big deal about that is that in professional football, it's really, really difficult to think that you have the ability coming in to replace any one of the 47 or now 53 or whatever it is, players who are already there. They have at least a year of experience, right, on you. So what's going to happen probably is going to come down to potential. It's going to come down to their saying, he's not as good now, but I believe he can be better then. Hank Stram brought in 110 athletes to that camp. And over the period of 6-7 weeks, because we played more preseason games and all, and our training camp was in Vero Beach, Florida. It was Dodger Town, one of the finest facilities in the country, but not in July and August, okay? And so we're literally, I mean, I would lose, the big guys would lose between 14 and 16 pounds a practice. You want to drink a lot of fluids, you don't want to eat, so it was just crazy. So I was in the fight for my life, I felt, as far as making the team was concerned. And getting down to about 2 weeks left, they hadn't really concentrated much on the offensive line, it didn't seem. I didn't see guys, you know, leaving, being cut at that point. And so they began, though, that week it was clear they were going to concentrate on the offensive line. Hank Stram was there for most of the drills. And that Monday morning, we're doing a drill, single player drill, where we're supposed to come out of our stance and keep our feet moving and hit the bag with as, you know, much perfection as we've learned. And I guess I did that. I didn't feel really that good that morning. I felt kind of sick, to be honest with you. And as I was hitting the bag, I went into kind of this trance kind of thing. It was later explained to me. I'm kind of, you know, and I could hear, Stanfield was the coach. He had kind of a gruff voice, and I could hear him in the distance going, "Hubbard, what's the matter with you? Don't stop your feet. You never stop your feet." You know, and I'm like this. And he comes up, he grabs my face mask, looks at my face is white as a sheet. Get the helmet off, call an ambulance, breathing in a paper bag, hyperventilating. Pretty soon, I find myself in Vero Beach Hospital. And I'm in a room I notice that's different than all the rest of the rooms. It's a corner room, and in this room, there's another room outside my room, glass window, and everybody who comes into my room gets into the equivalent of a hazmat suit before they come in. I said, that's a little odd. And so I ask, what's going on? Well, I had contracted a dysentery. Only one on the team. They told me, which was interesting, they said, yeah, I said, you know, this happened. They said, last year, nobody knows this, they said, last year the Miami Dolphins almost lost their entire season because there was a, you know, leech in the line, the water line, dysentery, somebody got it, then another player got it, and he said, this is a mess. I said, well, when can I get out of here? They said, we can get out of here when we culture the particular strand that this is, okay, and then we can give you the treatment and you can get out. I was in the hospital for a week. First thing that happened was, you know, I have to go to the bathroom, obviously. I had a male nurse, and he hands me a bedpan, and I said, that's not happening. Okay. I had a bathroom in the room. You know. So he argued, and we argued, and I finally convinced him. I got up, made my way to the bathroom. When I woke up, you know the wheelchair bars in the wall? It was in my hand. I'd ripped it out of the wall. I'd passed out. So I lay in the hospital, and I am so angry with God at this point. You have got to be kidding me. You are the one, God, that I felt opened the door, because I felt my call was to the ministry, but far before football got in the, you know, became on the scene. And so it's like, you know, I don't need to do this, but if so, that's fine. And so, but I got sucked in. I mean, I was pulled in. I was all in. And so I wanted to make the team, and I'm fighting and doing all the rest, but I feel God's with me, because God had kind of, the conversation I had with God, we said, look, this could be a tremendous platform for you in terms of sharing Christ with your buddies on the team, sharing Christ in other opportunities to speak, you name it. So that's the track I'm on. And it was about Thursday of that week, so I'm laying there, having been arguing with God, and very quiet. I'm not really praying. I'm not talking to you right now. And God revealed to me in a series of questions that went something like this. Dave, how many roommates have you had in the times in camp that you've been here? turns out I had had more roommates than any other player that year, with guys getting cut in the room when the phone call rings and you don't know which one of you it is, only to be told, bring your playbook, which you know at that point it's over. And then God says, and how many of those guys did you take the opportunity to talk about your relationship with me? And the answer was zero. I was so afraid at that point that I might be known as the Christian guy, the church guy, the religious guy, that in one case, I had a guy who, as much as said, what must I do to be saved? He was going through a struggle with his marriage, leading potentially to divorce. And I just kind of skirted around with some psychology babble, whatever, rather than going to my Bible and giving him some real good advice. And at that point, I experienced, you know, the lie, the alarm, the look, the lesson, and the tears. And I just wept. And at that point, you must be undone. I was completely undone. It's like, how now? I'm a week in the hospital. I lost 36 pounds. How on earth am I going to come out of this and still make the team? But you see, it wasn't up to me entirely. It was up to God and what God wanted to do. And he had already worked that out. Turns out I had already made the team, just didn't know it. Okay. So again, to become, we must be undone. And so in the table talk time, let's talk about those issues and how God works in our lives to really take us where he wants us to be. Father, thank you for this time in your word where we see all that happened to Peter, Lord. Thank you for that look that you gave.